this is where we live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Did you know millennials and adults over 50 face similar challenges in the job market? Coming up, we talk with author Lori Rassis, an employment attorney and author of Over the Hill, but Not Over the Cliff. Her book offers guidance to workers 50 years and older on ways to push past ageism in the workplace. And later, HQ2. Amazon recently announced it's looking to open a second headquarters in North America, which means spending billions to construct the new location and the promise of 50,000 new jobs. The news got officials scrambling across the country, including here in Connecticut, to submit proposals. Now, bringing the tech giant to this region will be welcome news to a state and capital city struggling with huge deficits and few options left to plug them. Coming up, could Hartford or maybe Bridgeport really attract Amazon.com? We'll find out what the company's really looking for, and of course, we want to hear from you too. The number 860-275-7266. You can email where we live at WMPR.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. But first, another week, another hurricane. Irma, now a tropical storm, caused many Florida residents to evacuate, whether scrambling further north or out of state before the storm made landfall. As of this morning, the storm's dumping rain on North Florida before it will head into Alabama and Tennessee, much weaker than it was as it moved up Florida's southwest coast. Now, are you a former state resident who moved to Florida only to find yourself back in Connecticut for a few days to ride Irma out? Tell us how you prepared. Or are you worried about relatives still in Florida? The number again, 860-275-7266. Now, joining us first is Ryan Hanrahan, meteorologist at NBC Connecticut. His blog is called On Ryan's Radar. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning, Lucy.
So what made this storm, Irma, so baffling as that we were looking at where it would end up?
Well, Irma was quite fascinating in that it was the longest Atlantic hurricane we've ever seen that stayed at its Category 5 intensity for as long as it did. A lot of times we get a storm that peaks at a Category 5 for 12 or 18 hours, then weakens. Irma was able to do it for days, and that's what really caused so much destruction through portions of the Caribbean, the British Virgin Islands, Barbuda, and even parts of the U.S. Virgin Islands. And then as the storm moved to the west, there was always a question of how quickly it would turn north into Florida. Would it turn north closer to the Bahamas or the east coast of Florida, or would it turn north a little bit later over the west coast of Florida? And so trying to figure out exactly when that turn was going to happen was sort of the forecast challenge over the last few days.
And it's called the cone of probability, the cone of uncertainty. Do people read that cone in a way that makes them feel like they could be safe if they just stay put because you think it just goes up the middle?
Well, that's a really good point. So the cone of uncertainty, I sort of like to say that it is become a victim of its own success. You see the cone of uncertainty everywhere. It's ubiquitous. You see it on TV. You see it in the newspaper. You see it online. But I'm not sure everyone really understands what the cone of uncertainty means. So the cone of uncertainty is just trying to show you where there is the likelihood the center of the storm will cross. And so for the most part, the center of the storm stayed in that cone of uncertainty, moving along the southwest coast of Florida. The problem is sometimes you get these storms that are as large as Hurricane Irma, and the threat for hurricane force winds extended way beyond what the cone was showing. So the cone's only really showing you where the center of the storm or the eye is going. It doesn't really show you how far the impacts will stray from the center, and that can be a little misleading.
Now, when we compare Irma to Harvey, Harvey dumped record amounts of rain. With Irma, was more of the danger the force of the wind and possibly the surge?
Yeah, so that's exactly right. So with Harvey, I mean, Harvey hit a relatively unpopulated area in Texas with its storm surge and its rain. So it was a little east of Corpus, with storm surge and its wind, just east of Corpus Christi. But the heavy rain fell in Houston, and that was the big problem with Harvey. With Irma, it was sort of all of the above. We had problems with flooding. Right now, Jacksonville's getting a lot of freshwater and storm surge flooding. It's sort of happening in tandem. We had problems with storm surge. It looks like some of the Florida Keys were really, really hit hard with storm surge, talking about 10 feet of inundation on some of the Florida Keys. And then the problems with wind. We saw some roofs ripped off some homes around Naples, lots of trees down, millions of people without power. So Irma really had sort of all of the different tropical threats, although I will say Irma did weaken quite a bit by the time it got to Florida. So it was a Category 5 as it moved into Cuba, but it spent about 24 hours over Cuba, and that weakened the storm substantially. So by the time it made landfall in Florida, it was a Category 3 storm. And a lot of the pictures we're looking at in Florida this morning are bad, but they could have been a whole lot worse.
And do we know yet how badly the Keys were hit?
We know that Key West suffered some damage, but some of the Keys just east of there were hit very, very hard. So there's a lot of damage on some of those islands. They're not particularly densely populated, though, so it's taking a little bit of time. U.S. 1, the highway there with all the causeways that gets you from Miami down to Key West is impassable in some spots. So it won't really be until people can get on the ground and take a look at some of the damage that we'll have a full assessment of what happened there.
So we've seen two very dangerous hurricanes in this hurricane season. In terms of predicting storms going forward, are enough resources being allocated to study hurricane science, Ryan, considering everyone's focus on climate change and these more powerful storms we may be seeing?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Unfortunately, the United States for a long time, for decades, has really been lagging other parts of the world in our numerical weather predictions, so the computer models we use to forecast the weather. The American computer model did quite poorly predicting Irma for most of Irma's lifetime. The European computer model, you've probably heard us talk about that before blizzards or before hurricanes, before Hurricane Sandy, the European model was what did such a good job. So we have a ways to go, and that's really an investment in trying to catch up with the Europeans in how well they're doing. In terms of the climate connection with Irma and Harvey, the links between climate change and hurricanes are a bit more tenuous than other links between climate change and other types of extreme weather, but they're there. I mean, we have extremely warm waters, warmer than usual, warmer than you would see without humans impacting climate and making the world a warmer place. And you also have more moisture in the atmosphere. The warmer the air, the more ability it has to hold water. And that's one of the reasons we saw such problems with Hurricane Harvey in Texas, because we were able to squeeze out so much rain and so much water. But I think the bigger issue in Florida, especially, and even in Texas around Houston, is we have a really big problem with building in very vulnerable places. I mean, you look at some of the places in Southwest Florida where people have homes surrounded by canals 2 feet above sea level. You know, with rising sea levels, we are building and we're subsidizing building in extremely vulnerable locations. And that's going to be a really big problem over the coming decades with more hurricanes like Irma and Harvey.
Ryan Hanrahan, meteorologist at NBC Connecticut. His blog is called On Ryan's Radar. Ryan, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Lucy.
This is Where We Live. We're talking about Hurricane Irma, now a tropical storm. Reports say more than half of Florida is without power, and that's the case for our next guest. I want to welcome into the conversation Michael Grunwald, senior writer for Political Magazine and author of The Swamp, The Everglades, Florida, and The Politics of Paradise. Michael, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
You probably heard our Connecticut meteorologist here, Ryan Hanrahan, talking about some parts of Southwest Florida where it doesn't really make sense to live and to build. You just wrote something recently about the idea of Florida as paradise. But when you have storms like these come through, it really makes people think about why they live there. Tell us a little bit about what brought you to Florida.
Well, it's funny. I mean, I went down to write a book about the Everglades. And essentially about water in Florida, and what you find when you particularly when you read some of these old accounts is that people assumed that South Florida would never be inhabited because it was too wet. It was disgusting. The U.S. Army soldiers who chased the Seminole Indians around Florida swamps in the 1830s really were mystified by why Washington had told them to do this, instead of just leaving this uninhabitable wasteland to the Indians and the mosquitoes. It seemed preposterous that anybody would want to live here full time in such a swampy, bug infested, you know, the words they used words like hideous and monstrous and diabolical and godforsaken. They really thought it was terrible. But the only problem was water. And what people realized is that if you could get rid of the water, you could turn it into a really nice place, and Florida really is a nice place, except when it isn't.
So you're a Miami resident?
I am.
And where did you evacuate to?
So I'm in Orlando right now. I'm looking out my mother-in-law's window, and I see branches strewn all over the driveway, which happened overnight while I was sleeping. You can tell what an ace journalist I am. I had no idea.
So you mentioned water control. What about the man who invented the air conditioner? Isn't he seen as a state hero in Florida?
Well, it's funny. I mean, definitely people talk about air conditioning. People talk about bug spray. People even talk about Social Security as the things that drew people to Florida. But it was really water control that did the trick. And first, the water control was inadequate. Remember, like in the early 1900s, when South Florida was still pretty empty, you know, compared to the rest of the country, that's when people started starting to try to drain the swamp, to use a phrase that we're hearing again these days. And they would go and they'd show people the land during the winter and say, oh, it's beautiful. It's, you know, it's never going to flood. And the suckers would buy it. And then the summer rains would come and it would flood again. And that's when Florida real estate became this national punchline, right? Like land by the gallon. I've got some swamp land in Florida I'd like to sell you. I don't know if you ever saw the Groucho Marx movie, Coconuts. Is about the sort of Florida land boom. But people really did buy, and then until in 1926, a hurricane wiped out Miami. And so you've had this sort of boom and bust forever in South Florida over the last century. And I think it's very unlikely that it's going to stop because, again, it may be an uninhabitable paradise, it may be an unsustainable paradise, but it really is nice.
And there is a drawback to that water control when you see a storm like this in terms of when there is a lot of rain. Where does the water go?
Well, exactly. I mean, you see it less during a storm like this where actually the engineering helps prepare by sort of blasting some of that water out of the way. But what we've definitely seen over the last century are these incredible environmental consequences of basically engineering a swamp so that 8 million people can live around it. And, you know, just last year on the Treasure Coast north of Miami, you saw one of America's most beautiful and popular estuaries was suddenly shrouded in this flocculent glop that looked like guacamole and smelled like a sewer. And again, that was essentially water managers blasting water out of Lake Okeechobee, which is the big sort of water body in the middle of the peninsula surrounded by this kind of flimsy dike. And they had to get the water out of there because they were afraid if it got too high, you'd have another hurricane come and blast it through its dike. I don't know if you've ever read Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston, but that's really the story of the 1928 hurricane, which killed 2,500 people living in the Everglades. At this point, there are 100 times more people living in harm's way than there were in 1928. So you can only imagine the kind of catastrophe if we had another hurricane like that.
Michael Grunwald, a senior writer for Political Magazine and author of The Swamp, The Everglades, Florida, and the Politics of Paradise. I want to welcome into our discussion now a voice that many people who listen to NPR are familiar with, Frank Tavares, who lived in Connecticut for some time. Just in the last year, he moved down to Florida, to Coral Springs, South Florida. Frank, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back with you, and it's a pleasure to talk with you today, as opposed to yesterday. This was part of the deal of, I think I'm going to trade the ice and snow of New England for the occasional hurricane of Florida. And in planning, that seems like such a great idea until you're in the middle of it. Like Michael just said, it's a great place to live, except when it isn't.
So how did you prepare, Frank? Because you moved down there late last summer. I think you had a fairly uneventful season last year, but this time Irma's headed your way, or you heard Irma was headed your way. How did you prepare?
Well, first of all, as Ryan was talking about the cone of uncertainty a few minutes ago, when you're looking at that from the outside, it's all theoretical and it's, oh, that's interesting. I wonder which way it will go. When you're in the middle of it, it's really crucial. And so we have shutters on the house, accordion shutters, so we were able to deploy those towards the end of the week. Thursday is when we buttoned everything up. We had our water supplies. We had non-perishable food ready. We were preparing for the inevitable power outage. We were lucky and were among the 50% in our area who did not lose power, lost internet, but that's nowhere near as difficult. We found a place in the house, as so many had suggested to us, that was protected inside, had no windows to the outside. We went to the mattresses. We put mattresses in that particular area. We had our important papers in folders, our birth certificates, insurance stuff, everything. And we had go-to bags ready just in case it became inevitable that we needed to get out. And that was, Lucy, the most difficult thing, is trying to make that decision. Should we evacuate? We were not in an evacuation area, but knowing how bad the wind could get, should we make a run for it? And we went back and forth trying to make this decision, understanding that the longer we waited, the more difficult it would be. And then looking at the reports and listening to the reports of people who were evacuating from further south, Miami and, of course, the Keys, the highways were jammed. Fuel was iffy, and we finally decided, you know, rather be here in our house, take the chances, than be caught in the open at the side of the road with no tank in the gas.
And Frank, when you opened up your windows, your doors this morning, what's the damage like?
A lot of debris. We lost one old deciduous tree, a rather large tree, but it fell sideways, so if it had changed direction, it would have hit the enclosure that we have around the deck. So we were lucky there. They're supposed to come through sometime this morning or later today and clear the debris out of the street so we can actually get on the road and leave, although many of us are not going to be interested in doing that for a while. I feel really lucky. When we saw that cone moving to the west, God bless the folks on the western part of the state as it was moving up towards Tampa, but we realized we would be dealing with Category 1 winds and not the Category 3. And there's a huge difference between those categories, as anybody who's been watching and listening can tell you. So we've got a bit of cleanup to do, and it'll be a couple of days before we get back to, and I'm doing air quotes for us, a normal. We live near a golf course, which is ironic since neither my wife nor I are golfers, but I can look out and I see that the sand traps are all water hazards mm-hmm. now, but the water didn't come up high enough to where it was a threat to us a couple of hundred yards away. But I got to tell you, Lucy, it gets your attention. It's that kind. And the other thing about being buttoned up in the house when you have the shutters is you can't see outside. You can hear the wind, you can hear the banging, you can hear the shrieking, and you're wondering what the heck is going on out there, but you can't look.
So. Well, Frank, well, we're glad to hear that. That sounds like not too much damage. We're glad to hear that you and your family and your dog are doing all right.
Oh, yes, yeah, with an adventure for the dog, too.
Well, again, Frank Tavares, a former Connecticut resident who lives in South Florida now. Many know him as the voice of NPR. Frank, thanks so much. I wanted us to turn back to Michael Grunwald, a senior writer for Politico magazine, quickly. Again, it sounds like Irma could have been worse, and this storm won't stop people from moving to Florida.
Well, exactly. I mean, Frank is, as I'm sure Frank knows, he lives in the former Everglades. But most of us don't know that. We get an alligator in our backyards and we call animal control. It doesn't occur to us that we're in the alligator's backyard. We're living in a floodplain, and they call them that because it's plain that they flood. and look, we do have this collective amnesia. Frank wasn't here when Hurricane Andrew came through. I wasn't here either. And most of us, we don't go through our lives thinking like, oh, well, maybe a disaster will come that will, uproot us and force us to rethink everything. We just live our lives. And I think most people in Florida, this is going to be forgotten pretty quickly, just like all the storms that came before it.
Michael Grunwald, author of The Swamp, The Everglades, Florida, and The Politics of Paradise, also senior writer for Politico magazine. Michael, thanks for your time. We're glad to hear you're doing well.
Hi, anytime.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, we shift to an announcement by Amazon that got Connecticut and many other states pretty excited. Could one of our cities become the future home of HQ2? We'll find out more after the break, and you can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. A technology giant got cities across America dreaming about becoming the home of Amazon.com's second headquarters. Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos has said his company's looking to invest $5 billion into this new location and plans to hire and create 50,000 new jobs. Connecticut is just one of many across the country that will submit a proposal to Amazon before the October 19th deadline. Do you think Connecticut has a chance? Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Now, what's the company really looking for in its second headquarters, HQ2? To tell us more, we're joined now by Brian Fung, tech reporter for The Washington Post. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about what exactly Amazon.com is looking for in these requests for proposals.
Well, it's a number of things, and all of these factors they say are not ranked. They're just kind of key guidelines that they're hoping that cities are going to try and follow when they're pitching their proposals. One of them is that cities should be close to an international airport. They should have easy access to public transit. They should have a vibrant culture that employees would be able to live and work and have fun in. They're looking for cities that are generally filled with more than a million people. And note, when I say cities, we're really talking metropolitan areas here. So one area that has been talked about is the Northeast Corridor here, the New York City, Baltimore, Washington, D.C. But then you also have your more typical areas such as San Francisco, Austin, Dallas, New Orleans, and the like.
I understand Washington Post narrowed it down to 39 places. Is Connecticut on the list, Brian?
Connecticut is not on the list, unfortunately, but I believe there have been a number of Connecticut officials who've tweeted that Amazon should try and make its new headquarters there anyway.
I wanted to bring into the discussion Stephen Singer, business reporter for the Hartford Current. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So tell us about Connecticut's chances. We've already heard the Washington Post says, well, they're not, according to how they looked at criteria, that Connecticut doesn't make the list. But what do we have going for us?
Well, Connecticut is going to make a pitch for it, and there's two regions that will be candidates. One is the Fairfield-New Haven corridor, which includes Yale University and several other universities, and Connecticut officials say they've got a lot of really great livable communities along the shoreline. The other one is the Hartford region. Mayor Bronin last week said this is a great opportunity for the region to think of itself as a region and not just a city. One of the things that Brian mentioned about airports is telling, because when GE left Connecticut in 2016 and went to Boston, one of the reasons was the proximity to Logan Airport. So that doesn't bode well if that's a big item for Amazon. We have Bradley Airport, but that's regional. That's not a first rank international airport.
Now, Brian, and what are the chances for secondary markets? You mentioned San Francisco, but that's an area that's really crowded with competitors. And how are they going to find the 50,000 people they want to hire, that talent?
That's right. And so Amazon is basically trying to walk a very fine line here, trying to find a city that's not too exposed, or overexposed. You could say San Francisco, New York. These types of places are cities that have a very high cost of living. People are, cramming in there and really having trouble finding housing. A lot of tech companies are worried that maybe they may not be able to hire enough people, which could be a concern given that Amazon wants to hire as many as 50,000 people to work in its new headquarters. This could mean that they may look towards smaller cities, perhaps like Nashville or Orlando, as a way to try and drum up some more interest, get people to perhaps move to places where the cost of living isn't quite so high.
Now, do you think that Connecticut could be in the running for Amazon.com's HQ2? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. I wanted to go back to Steve Singer with the Hartford Current. You mentioned the Fairfield, New Haven area being part of the proposal that Connecticut will submit or is in the running. Why not Bridgeport-Stamford? Isn't Stamford pretty a pretty happening place? And Bridgeport may have the room for something like this, the space for a headquarters this size?
That would be part of the that corridor. Bridgeport is in Fairfield County, and I saw one. I think it was Market Watch had a list of possible areas that could be seriously considered, and Bridgeport was one of them. One of the other points with the 50,000 employees, that would make Amazon, if it chose Connecticut, it would make it probably the biggest private employer. The whole employment level in Connecticut is about 1.7 million, which would make 50,000 almost 3% in one shot, which is raises questions about how you could absorb 50,000 employees in a labor force of a little shy of 1.7 million.
We're getting a tweet from a listener, Mark, who writes, in terms of scale, Connecticut has what it takes, but city cores must be made more walkable, transit-rich, which requires investment. That could be a place where we'd be hurting, Steve.
State officials have been, you know, talking about the state of the cities for years now. Hartford is making some changes. They have a new minor league stadium. They brought the University of Connecticut downtown. These are all areas they point to, but it's going to be many, many years before Hartford or Bridgeport and other cities get to the level that might be attractive to an employer like Amazon.
This is Where We Live. Today we're talking about the recent announcement from Amazon.com that it's looking for proposals to build its second headquarters in North America. Connecticut is joining a list of many regions around the country that are hoping for this, HQ2. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. We're getting another tweet from Eduardo, who writes, poor Connecticut, between the brains of Boston and the money and glitz of New York, has better parking, though. It almost sounds like we're selling ourselves short. There's a lot of talent here, right, Steve?
It is kind of a tricky area when you're marketing yourself as being near two other really great places. Connecticut does that a lot because of its proximity to these two very large cities, one of the biggest in the country, and then Boston in addition. It opens itself up to questions about if you're so great, why are you marketing yourself as being close to two other cities?
I want to go back to Brian Fung, a tech reporter for The Washington Post. WAPO narrowed it down to 39 places, 39 regions around the country that could be in the running for this second headquarters. With the acquisition of Whole Foods, Brian, could that maybe play a part in where Amazon.com puts its headquarters? Is it closer to Texas?
Well, that's a great question, and a lot of folks, think that given that Amazon's existing headquarters is on the West Coast, that it might make sense for Amazon to shift its operations, its second headquarters, to the East Coast. One good advantage it gets by doing so is that it then gets to cover pretty much the entire United States in terms of time zones. You would have people waking up in the East Coast, working East Coast hours, not lagging behind the East Coast when the West Coast wakes up, that sort of thing, which is going to be increasingly important as Amazon expands its operations, both in groceries but also in other sectors and in the United States and abroad as well.
And give us an idea when we hear this promise of 50,000 new jobs. What kinds of jobs are we talking about, Brian?
Well, they're mostly higher-end jobs, managerial jobs, engineering jobs. This is, to be clear, it's not a manufacturing plant, which raises some interesting questions as far as, how someone like President Trump will receive, the announcement of a potential HQ somewhere in the 50 states. It is important to point out here, as an aside, the proposal from Amazon, or request for proposals, I should say, covers not just the United States, but also the rest of North America, including Canada and Mexico. So Montreal, Ottawa, Toronto, and Mexico City all made our list. And so there's a question here as to, what the political ramifications are for Amazon if it decides to host its HQ2 somewhere else.
That's a good point. And Steve Singer from the Hartford Current, business reporter for The Current. Tell us a little bit about what footprint Amazon has in Connecticut in terms of warehouses.
It has warehouses in Wallingford and in Windsor, and it's building a third in North Haven. It's got its presence also, obviously, in several Whole Foods stores. But those are the three warehouses in Connecticut.
And, Brian, so proposals will be accepted until October 19th. How soon could Amazon.com make a decision?
That's a great question. I mean, the tech industry moves incredibly fast these days, so I wouldn't be surprised to see, Amazon moving quickly on this. That said, this is a very big decision. There aren't very many companies in the United States or around the world who have two headquarters in the same country. So this is really a big deal, and, it's going to be interesting to see how Amazon decides to play this.
Brian Fung, tech reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you, Brian, for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Also, Stephen Singer, business reporter for The Hartford Current. Steve, thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. A company like Amazon can attract young workers, especially in the tech sector. But what about older Americans, especially the long-term unemployed who are over 50? We'll find out what opportunities are available for them, and we'll hear from an author on the best ways older residents can market themselves in an ever-changing job market. Now, you can join the conversation, too, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Join me tomorrow night at 6 at the Warner Theater in Torrington for Making Her Story. It's a new Where We Live series highlighting the stories of prominent Connecticut women. We'll hear tomorrow from Hartford Symphony Orchestra music director Carolyn Kwan, and we'll take audience questions too. Please join us. More details at our website, WMPR.org. Now, the national unemployment rate is at 4.4%, nearly its lowest rate in 16 years. How are older workers or people who fit this long-term unemployed category faring? What job opportunities are out there for them, too? According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, more Americans over 55 are working now than ever before. But that doesn't mean workers 50-plus and over don't face challenges in finding and retaining jobs. Are you one of them? Tell us your experience. 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I want to welcome into the conversation Lori Rassis, author of Over the Hill, But Not the Cliff, 5 Strategies for 50-plus Job Seekers to Push Past Ageism and Find a Job in the Loyalty-Free Workplace. Lori, welcome to Where We Live.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Tell us about the challenges that face older workers and what they may have in common with millennials.
Right. So I think when we're talking about older workers, the idea that people sort of need to think about is it's not really the older workers' age that we have to contend with, but it's really sort of the stereotypes of what the age represents. And so the issue really is that when somebody is 50, 60, or 70, and an employer sort of is looking at them as for a potential job, they sort of have these preconceived notions about them more so than other candidates. And so that's a challenge because a lot of times those workers aren't even considered because of these stereotypes.
Tell us about the stereotypes that someone has when they're interviewing someone in that category.
Yeah, so there's sort of a couple buckets that they fall into. So one is sort of if you close your eyes for a minute, you sort of think of someone who's older. Let's just say 80, for example. The question is, what do you think of when you see this person? And, you think they're tired and they want to be lying on a beach and they don't want to learn anymore. And, they're certainly not going to be sitting in front, they don't have the technology in front of them. All these sort of things come into the play. So one thing is that they're tired. One thing is that they don't have energy to really sort of be a go-getter. There's also this idea that as you're 55 or maybe approaching 60, you're more interested in retirement than your career. There's an idea that you sort of feel as if you've learned enough and you know it all and you don't really have more to learn. And of course, technology is a big issue that older candidates face, which is you're not interested in technology, you don't have the skills that are current, and so that's going to be sort of a negative against you. Those are sort of the stereotypes.
Now, you're an employment attorney, mm-hmm. and we know age discrimination is illegal, so mm-hmm. how do people get away with it?
Mm-hmm. So I think that, yes, it's true. Age discrimination is illegal, but we also know that so is sexism and so is racism and so are a lot of other things. And so the point is that most people today really are aware that it's illegal to consider age, and what they do is it sort of goes underground. First of all, some people do it innocently. They may not know that they have these unconscious biases. But really what happens is rather than sort of saying, I mean, it's very rare that I have a client that, you know, is told, you're too old. I mean, no one's really going to say that because they know generally that that's not permissible. And so there's sort of other sort of things that sort of, you know, bring age into it. For example, I hear a lot, you know, you're too experienced, or you earn too much money, or, you know, why do you want this job? You know, aren't you ready to retire? It sort of comes up sort of, you know, with characteristics. I mean, the biggest thing I hear is people say they're too experienced or they earn too much money, which is sort of could be viewed as an idea of basically saying you're too old, right? Because nobody's telling a 30-year-old you make too much money or you have too much experience. So it sort of comes up indirectly, and it's a little more hidden because people are aware that it's not permissible.
Now, I mentioned that older workers may have more in common than millennials in terms mm-hmm. of trying to find a job. Talk us through what millennials have experienced trying to get that job.
Yeah, so I think it actually is sort of interesting that there is a lot of commonality between millennials and older workers, even though they don't see it. And by that, I mean, I talk to a lot of millennials, and millennials complain, you know, people think I'm young, people think I can't do this work, there's so many stereotypes, people think I'm lazy. But then in the same sentence, the millennials will say, well, that person's too old. So it's sort of interesting that, you know, millennials complain that they don't want to be stereotyped, and older candidates say that they don't want to be stereotyped, and they actually stereotype each other. And so in an ideal world, I mean, from the employer's perspective, and I do a lot of coaching with employers, the idea is to take age out of the conversation because, you know, if you're looking for something and, you know, you need the best talent and you want to recruit the top talent, why do you care if they're 22 or if they're 50 or if they're 60? I mean, you should really focus on those job characteristics and sort of get rid of those stereotypes.
This is Where We Live. On the phone with us, Lori Rassis, author of Over the Hill But Not the Cliff, five strategies for 50-plus job seekers to push past ageism and find a job in a loyalty-free workplace. Maybe that is something that refers to you. And if you want to join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Tell us how you're navigating the job market if you fit this category. Now, Lori, I wanted to mention, you know, earlier in the segment, I talked about the unemployment rate being at its lowest levels. Since the recession, we've heard about this category, a long-term unemployed, someone who may have lost their job and it's just taking them a long time to try to find work. Mm-hmm. How difficult is it for them to get that foot in the door because is an employer looking at someone's resume and saying, well, you've been out of work for a number of years, why should I be hiring them?
Yeah, so that's a good point. And I think for older candidates, it's just sort of another obstacle to overcome. And so, yes, if you're older, that's an obstacle. And if you've been unemployed, regardless of your age, it's another obstacle to overcome. So I think it's a concern. I think the same thing that you need to do if you're not employed, first of all, I would say if you're not working, you want to stay engaged. You want to get a part-time job. You want to, you know, make yourself visible so that you have somebody to say. I mean, if somebody says, what have you been doing for the past 8 months? You don't want to say nothing, right? You want to show because, again, it's feeding into the stereotype, particularly if you're older, because if it's been 8 months and you haven't had a job, the perception is you don't have the skills, you haven't abandoned interest in learning, you know, why aren't you out there doing things? It sort of feeds into the age stereotype, so it sort of compounds the issue. And the other thing that you might find interesting is that a lot of states are starting to see long-term unemployment as an issue that's unrelated to sort of whether or not you can do the job and are starting to outlaw unemployment, meaning it's going to be, you know, in some states it's already impermissible to consider unemployment. So, I mean, I practice law in New York City, and in New York City, unemployment actually is what's called a protected class, meaning you're not permitted to say, if you're unemployed, need not apply, and you're not permitted to consider that. So a lot of states are sort of seeing this as an issue, particularly for older candidates. And so I think that the trend is sort of, you know, there are sort of some things that are being done to counter that. The other thing I think is that unemployment used to be sort of a very big stigma, but because of the economy, there are actually a lot of fantastic candidates that are, you know, no longer working or have been laid off. I know at the beginning of my career, the idea was, if you were laid off, well, you were probably terrible, and you probably weren't a good employee because, you know, the company would find something for you or they would keep you. But that doesn't happen anymore. You know, companies have to do less with more, and I mean more with less, and there really are great candidates that are laid off. So I think the good news is there's less of a stigma, that if you were laid off, it's not so much, oh, you're a terrible employee, it's just because, you know, the company had to downsize. And so there's some great candidates in this sort of, you know, section. And for employers, I would say this is actually a market to tap into because, you know, for employers, you can get some great candidates by actually tapping into this market of older employees who may have been laid off, but really are dedicated employees and really do want to work and have a lot to contribute.
Now, Lori, walk us through if I'm someone who is over 50 and I'm looking to get a job, how should I market myself on a resume? And then once I get that interview, how should I do the interview with someone where they're not going to just see my age?
Okay, so a couple things. So first of all, you want to sort of think about all the stereotypes, and you want to make sure your resume sort of counters them. So for example, the idea is, you know, that you don't have an interest in learning, and the idea is that you don't have technology skills. So on your resume, you want to sort of showcase those skills. So you want to put those skills, technology skills, front and center. If you have a Twitter account, you want to get, you know, you want to sort of put your Twitter handle on your resume. You want to make sure you're active on social media. You want to go on LinkedIn. You want to have a profile. You want to connect. You want to post. You really want to have a digital presence so that if somebody's not sure about your technology skills, they could do a quick search and they see that you're an active person in technology. So you want to highlight those. That's the biggest sort of first thing you want to do is make sure technology is front and center. The second thing is, you know, there's this idea of an abandoned interest in learning. So you really want to show that you're current. So you want to, if you haven't attended conferences, you want to start to attend conferences, and you want to highlight anything you've done recently. You don't want to say, you know, 20 years ago I was a team leader. You want everything that happened maybe 20 years before, you want to take that off your resume, and you want to show current examples of how you sort of have this interest in learning and being, you know, committed and being at the forefront of those types of things. You can write articles, you can give interviews, you can do speeches, you want to do all those things, and you want to highlight those so somebody will see you as an active participant. The other thing is, I know you have a lot of experience, and older candidates feel like they have lots and lots of experience. You want to sort of narrow it down. I always say avoid what I call a career obituary. You know, something that you did 40 years ago, it may have been great, but try to find examples that you've done in the recent past, because hopefully if you've done something great a long time ago, you've continued to do it, so you don't want to sort of highlight things way back when, because you want to show you have current examples.
You mentioned emphasizing technology such as LinkedIn. You know, some people might be like, oh, I don't even know how to use that. But there are programs, there are libraries out there that have LinkedIn classes. There are places people can go to get that kind of advice on how to get up to speed on technology that may not be, have been around 10 years ago. Where are some other places, resources people can use, Lori?
So I do think that's true. If you do a quick Google search, there's always going to be free webinars that you can do, free resources to use. So definitely online, you do a quick Google search, a lot of that will come up. You also can go to your local library. Assuming you have a college degree, you went to college, you go to alumni associations, you can go to the bar association, you can go to career fairs. There's lots of resources available, and there's really no reason not to have what's a LinkedIn profile. It's the idea a lot of recruiters are looking directly on LinkedIn. And if you have a LinkedIn profile, it's sort of the foundation. And if you don't have a LinkedIn profile, I think that's the first red flag that someone's going to say, well, this person doesn't have the basics, and you're sort of going to be passed over.
Give us the dynamic. So for someone who may be over 40, over 50, and they finally got that job they're looking for, and then they've got the younger boss. Any advice in terms of the dynamic there?
So I think that's sort of an issue that comes up because obviously the older you are, the more likely that's going to happen. And I would say the idea is just like you don't want to be judged by your age, I would say don't judge your younger boss by their age. And I think, it shouldn't really matter. Just like you don't want your boss to come in and say, oh, this person's 55 and sort of go through all the stereotypes, you don't want to do the same thing. And I can say I'm actually guilty of the same thing because I tell people this all the time. And I recently did a project, my boss and I were 15 years apart. So I started on the first day of the project, and my boss walked in, and I was 15 years older than him, and we were sort of discussing it for a while, and I realized I was sort of playing into the stereotype. And it ended up, I mean, he has been, you know, one of the best bosses I've ever had. And so the idea is just try to take age out of the conversation, because I'd much rather have a fantastic boss that's 20 years younger than a boss that's 3 years older that maybe doesn't treat me right. And so I think you just sort of have to put that aside. You're there to do the work. You want the top talent. You want the best boss you can have. And I think you just, again, try to take age out of the conversation. And if you don't address it and they don't address it, you know, it seems like that's the best way to sort of move forward.
Now, you, again, you titled your book Over the Hill, But Not the Cliff, Five Strategies for 50-plus Job Seekers. Why choose that title? Could some of what you're talking about apply to people 40 and over?
So a couple of things. So it's funny that you say that, because initially the book did refer to people that were 40 plus, and really for marketing purposes, I was actually advised to change it to 50 plus, because they say 40 people don't really consider themselves to be, you know, old. And so it's funny that you say that, because it really is applicable to everybody, right? I mean, nobody wants to be told, you know, if you're 30 or if you're, you know, 20, whatever your age is, if you have these sort of characteristics that you're tired and you're low energy and you don't want to learn a lot and you're not going to be coachable, that's going to be an issue for you. So really these are the sort of ways that can be used from any job seekers, and a lot of the advice is for anyone across the board. The general idea with any job search, regardless of your age or whatever challenge you're facing, is really that employers are looking for what I call, which is the Cinderella fit. Right, the employer basically says, this is what I want, this is exactly what I want. And so if you're older and you have too many years of experience, or if you're younger and you don't have enough experience, you're both unqualified, right? You just have to sort of figure out what exactly does the employer want, and you have to make it clear you're exactly that. Not more, not less, you have to be just right. And that's sort of what the book is geared towards doing. And if somebody says, I want someone who's going to be with me for 10 years and has technology, technological skills, you've got to show that you have that, regardless of your age, regardless of who you are. You want to sort of figure out what the employer wants and then show you've got exactly what they need, because there's a lot of competition for all jobs.
Now, Lori, we're getting a tweet from a listener who writes, I don't agree with the social media aspect. I can't stand Facebook, and rarely do I go on LinkedIn. What if people can't afford Wi-Fi? What then?
So I think, unfortunately, it's something that's going to have to be sort of somehow part of your process. And it does, I mean, it's very easy now sort of to sort of overcome those things. You could usually get Wi-Fi. You can go to the library. There's a lot of hotspots you can get from a local coffee shop. If you don't have technological skills, you could hire someone to help you. If you can't hire someone, I mean, I have a lot of clients who have their grandparents, you know, their grandchildren who set up their accounts. I mean, there are a lot of resources you can use, and it really is important. I mean, I don't necessarily particularly like social media either. I mean, I'm right there with a lot of people out there, but it does send a signal right off the bat if you're not out there. So it's sort of one of those things where, just like if you don't like to use a computer, I mean, you sort of have to sort of build those skills, but there are ways to do it in sort of a cost-effective way. So I would say go to the library, find a friend, find a child of a friend, and sort of help them establish your presence.
I want to squeeze in a quick call from a listener. Warren's calling from Danbury. Warren, we have a couple minutes. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm 56, actually, on disability right now, former IT technical management professional. And what the young woman is saying is, you know, the same stuff I heard about 20 years ago when I got laid off in my late 30s when the internet bubble tanked. And I'm highly technically trained, and it's the same stuff. Everything she said is kind of textbook. So the real world is, you got to look at the bigger picture that you're not talking about, which is, you know, A, criminally corrupt government and power structures that are single point of failure at the top of the power pyramid. Everything should be done by committee. There should be no people in positions of single authority. I mean, there's so many problems at the higher strategic level you're not addressing, and then tactically, you can solve some of the age discrimination issues with quotas. And that's probably the easiest way they could implement it, to get some fairness about age discrimination. Because she is right that, I mean, you get so highly discriminated over, like, it's just people that are inexperienced and they really don't know what they're doing being put in positions of HR, you know, hiring.
Okay, I'll have Lori Rassus respond. Sure. Thank you, Warren.
Sure, yeah, thank you for the comment. And I think that's a good point. And I think, you know, let's just say I agree with every single thing you say. I mean, let's say I agree that there's corruption and the people at the top are uneducated, and let's say I 100% agree with everything you say. I always say to people, that's fine, that may be the truth, but if you're looking for a job, you can't really take on the criminal, you can't really take on, you know, the criminal corruption at the top. You sort of have to say, okay, this is the environment we're in. We have this situation. There's corruption at the top, but what are we going to do? I mean, we're not going to change it when, you know, you're looking for a job and you have bills to pay. So what I try to do is sort of say, okay, ageism exists. It's there. It's wrong. It's illegal. We should eliminate it. That's fine. That may be a long-term goal for you to sort of get rid of it, but this is the circumstances we're in. So I say, you know, do what you have, get around the obstacles, get the job, and then change it from the inside, right? Get in and do whatever you have to do to get that job. And then maybe once you're there, and, you know, let's say this comes up a lot where people will say, well, they said something offensive about my age in the hiring process. What should I do? I say, depends if you want the job. Ignore it, move on, and get around it, and get the job, if that's your goal. And then once you're there, maybe change it from the inside.
And we'll have to leave it there, Lori. But thank you so much for a really interesting segment. Lori Rass is author of Over the Hill But Not the Cliff. And we'll send out information on our Twitter about the book. Lori, thanks again for your time today.
Yeah, thanks so much.
The Today Show, produced by Lydia Brown. Special thanks to Carmen Baskoff. Our technical producer is Kyone Wolf. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. If you don't have plans tomorrow night, consider joining us for Making Her Story at the Warner Theater in Torrington. Information at WMPR.org.